Good afternoon, Toronto. My name is Sally, and I am an alcoholic. Wow, that's louder than in my home group. I'd like to begin with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. It's a privilege and a joy and also a little nerve-wracking to be here. And I'm grateful to this fellowship for my life. I'm grateful to God for this fellowship. And I'm grateful to my three speakers for sharing this platform with me. And I'd like to begin without further ado with a wonderful gentleman I just recently met, Bob from Florida.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bob. I'm grateful to be here this morning, and I want to thank the committee who invited me. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am in good standing. And what that means is I haven't had a drink today, and for that I'll be forever grateful. We were just talking as we got up here. Who wants to go first? And nobody wanted to go first, and so here I am. And I woke up this morning with a big knot in my stomach. You know, I told my wife, I said, "Jesus, what am I going to say here?" You know, I tell you, these rehearsals are killing an alcoholic. Trying to figure out what I'm going to do here, but I just want to tell you a little bit about myself, and I'm going to go to my last two drunks. We all know how to drink, and I want to try to get into recovery a little bit, but I'm not only an alcoholic, I'm somebody's father, and I'm somebody's son, and I want you to know that I have 10 children, and they all grew up in spite of me. But the next of my last drunk, I never want to forget it because it was I'm from Florida, Daytona Beach, Florida, by the way, and my home group is the Last Call Group. And it's the best, and it's the best home group in AA. And if you don't think yours is, you might want to get another home group. So if you ever get down there, come see us. But anyway, it was, I want to back up a little bit because they say that alcohol is just a symptom of our problem. And I know that that's true because I never took a drink until I was 17 years old, but I hit my first jail when I was 12. So I had a lot of problems before I ever took my first drink of alcohol. I was 17 years old, and I joined the Marine Corps. And I was down in Parris Island, South Carolina in 1954. And by the way, my sobriety date is March the 10th, 1979. I took my first drink when I was 17, and I ended up in a military prison when I was 18. So I never drank well. Every time I drank, I got in trouble, and most of the time I went to jail. So they court-martialed me, and they put me into a military prison, and I hated the Marine Corps at that point in my life. I hated God, and I hated you. And the next 3 years in the Marine Corps was just one battle after another with alcoholism, and I got out of the Marine Corps, and I did not get an honorable discharge, and they didn't ask me to re-up. They were glad to get rid of me. And so anyway, my career, I got out of the Marine Corps when I was 21 years old, and I got to AA when I was 41. The next of my last drunk, and I had all these children. I've been married a lot, so I don't want to get into all my marriages. I used to say, hey, I know I got another marriage. I mean, I don't know if I got another divorce. I was one of those that could never form a relationship with another human being. I just couldn't do it. My marriages lasted about every 3 years. I used to rescue women, and a lot of people said, why don't you just live with them? But I had to marry them because I believed that if I could just get married and just have a child, that I'd be okay. And I had a lot of kids, and it didn't get okay. the next of my last drunk, I was in Jacksonville, Florida. And I had these 10 little children. And the ex-wife and I had one of the most horrendous fights that we had had. Now, we were married 15 years. And this fight this night was so horrific that I knocked her out, and I'm not proud of this, but I had a handful of wrapped coins, and I hit her in the head, and she fell down, and all these little children, and it was raining, and it was thundering, and I will never forget, I can still see her face of a little three-year-old sitting next to her mother, and she looked up at me, and she said, "I hate your guts," and I can see her face today. And that was 26 and a half years ago. I left that night, and they were begging me not to go, and I went to the nearest tavern, not knowing if their mother was dead or alive. And I walked in, and the barmaid came up to me, and I was bleeding because she had cut me on the face. And she came up with a dirty bar mop, and she wiped my face, and she said, "I'm so glad to see you. What do you have?" And I said, "I'll have a Budweiser." And in those days, Budweiser was 50 cent a can. And when I took the can of Budweiser, I realized that this was the most important thing in my life. It wasn't those 10 children at home. It wasn't that mother, but it was that I had the whole world in my hand. It was Budweiser. I went home and tried to patch things up. And I want to say here right now, if you have 10 little children, and you live in a house with a wife and 10 kids, and if you are not wanted, needed, and loved, you are the most unspiritual individual that walks the face of the earth. And that's what I was. About a month later, I had another drink, and I was in a bar. And this was my last drink, March the 10th, 1979. And it was a hostage situation. I had ran out of money. And I was one of those drunks that carried guns around. And I was very dangerous. I was a Jekyll and Hyde that you read about in the big book. And I held a bar room with about 35 people in there. And I had it was a hostage situation. And they called the Duval County SWAT team, and they came and they got me. And when I woke up the next morning, it's a wonder that I'm here today, because in those days, today this would not have happened, because they would have shot me right on the spot. And I woke up the next morning, and I was in a total blackout, and I did not know what I was in there for. And I reached in my pocket, and I opened up the tag there in my picture, and it had felony stamped across it, and I knew that I was in trouble. And I thought I had got another DUI. And so I got on the phone, and thank God for Al-Anon. Are there any Al-Anons here tonight? All right, God bless you, because I would not be standing here if it was not for the fellowship of Al-Anon. I got on the telephone. You get one phone call in jail, you know. And I called up in the Al-Anon. She had already been to an Al-Anon meeting. I didn't know it. And I said, "Would you please come get me out of this jail?" And she said, "I'll come and get you if you'll talk to somebody in AA." And she hung the phone up. So I had to wait 24 hours to make another phone call. And I called the next day. I said, "Are you going to come get me out of here? You've talked to somebody in AA." And she hung the phone up. The next morning, I called again. I said, "Would you please come get me out of this jail? I'll join the French Foreign Legion if I have to." So she came and got me, and I want to tell you, this was March the 10th, and in Jacksonville, Florida, you probably don't know it, but the azaleas bloom in March. And it was a beautiful, beautiful Sunday morning. It was gorgeous, and all the dogwood trees and the azaleas was blooming. I pulled up in front of this house where I lived, and I had a hedge of white azaleas. They were the most beautiful things that I'd ever seen. They were angelic. And I was just the opposite. Bill Wilson wrote an article one time, and he said, "You know, I always felt like I had to be in first place, but in my perverse heart, I always felt like I was the lowest of all of God's creatures." And that's just what I felt like. And those 10 kids were out there. And I got out of that car, and I was in three-day growth of beard. My clothes were ripped and bloody, and they just turned their heads the other way. And I walked into the house, and I got into the shower, and I tried to get clean. And I must have stayed in there for an hour, and I used a bottle of shampoo, and I washed, and I washed, and I just couldn't get clean. And it was just, it was awful. And I guess this is what they call an bottom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, the wife knocked on the door, and she said, "They're here." And I said, "Who's here?" "AA." And I went out into my living room, and here they were, Mutt and Jeff. One tall guy, about 6'3", and a little short, fat guy. And they talked to me for about 2 hours, and they left. And the little fat guy said, "I'll see you at 7. We're going to a meeting." And the other guy, I never saw him again. I went to my first meeting at San Marco in Jacksonville, Florida, which is the oldest AA clubhouse in Florida. It all started at San Marco. Yeah, thank you. Oh, I'll think over there, Florida. Yeah. You probably know my sponsor, Dick M. 80 years old, he's dying of ALS. And I go into this meeting, and a guy's standing up on the podium like this, and you know what he said? "If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk." I could have killed him. I knew that. I knew that in Korea. How are you going to do that, though? But you know he's right. And I look back today, because if I don't drink today, I'm not ever going to drink, because tomorrow's always today. And he was right. All these things in AA. So I get into AA, and my first few meetings, when they would stand up to say the Lord's Prayer, I would take one step backward. "Don't touch me." I didn't want to hear about God. I didn't come to AA. In fact, I was forced into AA by a judge. And for that little episode in the bar, I was facing 5 to 10 years in Rayford Penitentiary, and I'm a two-time loser. And the lawyer told me, he said, "You know, it doesn't look good. I've done all I can do, but it doesn't look good." My sponsor went to court with me. And I don't know, God loves alcoholics and babies, and I ended up getting on probation, and I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't like topics, especially the 12th step, where we would come in here and we'd go to meetings and they would talk about practicing these principles and all your affairs. And one guy stood up in a couple of my first meetings there and he said, "You know what Dr. Bob said? If you can't practice the 12 steps in your own home, you can't do it anywhere." And I died. I could do pretty good in AA, you know. Everybody's got a good program from 8 to 9, but what do you do when you leave? You have to go back to the house where those 10 kids were. And that Al-Anon. Al-Anon don't get chips, they get halos, you know. But we love Al-Anon. And so they said AA is a spiritual program. And I didn't want to get drunk. And I thought there might be something to this, and they told me to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and turn to page 45, and it said, "Lack of power, that's our problem. We got to find a power that will sustain us so we can live one day at a time without taking a drink of alcohol." And so I began to take practice the 12 steps, and I had a sponsor. Dick is a step guy. You know, if you go to Jacksonville, Florida, you're going to find step meetings all over the place. And it was step meetings and speaker meetings, step meetings and speaker meetings. The 12 steps are the program, he told me. You know, discussion meetings are nice, but if you want to get sober, you better get into the 12 steps. And that's what I did. And so I looked around AA, and I noticed, and I don't know about y'all, but I look at what people do in AA. And I noticed one thing, that the happiest people that I saw in AA... Now, check me out the next time you go back to your home group. The happiest people that I've seen in AA were the people who talked about God. And so I started hanging around. I started going to retreats. I got into this thing so big. I mean, I knew that this was a spiritual program. I knew, and I fought it, but I knew. I did some of the weirdest things. You know when they start talking about the 11th step and prayer and meditation? Man, I'm going to tell you one little thing that I did. When I was going to these retreats and everything, and I had another sponsor, she liked to go around and do some of these little weird churches and stuff. And we went to one of these things one time, and I was sober about 5 years at the time. And it was a place like this, and they had somebody walking back and forth, and they were putting their hands on people, and they were reading them. And I was sitting way in the back of a room about like this, about half as many people, and they were doing all kind of things to these people sitting down at a chair. So after it was over, we all got up and we started to leave, and this guy was up on the stage, and he come yelling at me, "Hey, you, wait a minute." And he come running up to me and said, "I know what your problem is." And I looked at him, and I didn't know I had a problem. And he says, "I can't quite put my finger on it, but what you need to do when you go home tonight, you need to find you a big pine tree, and you need to put your arms around that thing and squeeze it for everything it's got, and then you'll be okay." Well, we laughed about it, and we went home. It was about midnight, and I dropped this other lady off, and I went to my house. I lived out in the country, and it was after midnight when I got home, and I started to go into the door, and I looked around, didn't see anybody. Now, I had a bunch of pine trees out there, and I went up there, and I hugged that thing for everything it was worth, you know. But I found out when it was all said and done, and you can go to the library and you can find thousands of books on how to find a higher power. And I finally had to come back to AA, and they said, "Keep it simple when it comes to the God thing." He said, "Bob, you are finite, and God is infinite, and you're not ever going to get on that level anyway." So I kind of stuck with AA, and I found out one thing. And as spiritual as I'm ever going to get is when I'm working with another alcoholic. Can you imagine when you see that drunk, helpless, puking alcoholic come walking in the doors of AA? We've all seen this. And he sits down over here, and all of a sudden another alcoholic slips up beside him, and he starts to transfer the message. And the next thing you know, this guy or this gal is clean and sober. And she's talking about God, and her life never the same. It's a powerful thing. These steps are so big. And the longer we're sober, I found out another thing. The longer that I'm sober, the more sensitive I become to my character defects. Things that I didn't bother me last year. Sometimes I wonder, why'd you say that? And I just want to slap myself, you know? You ought to be further than that. And somebody will say, "No, you're right where you need to be, Bob." I'm grateful for AA, and out of all those 10 children, I do want to say, because this is a family disease, and it takes a toll on the whole family. You cannot live with an alcoholic and not have it affect your family. Out of those 10 children I had, one of them never saw me take a drink, and his name was Gino, and he was 24 years old, and my wife is sitting out here, who helped me raise her. And by the way, I just want to say, for this guy's been married all these times, all these women, and every one of them would have made any man a good wife, except one maybe. But Judy and I met in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we will have been married 13 years this Christmas Eve. And thank you. And I want to say something else that I don't say too casual around AA. Judy and I have never had a cross word in 13 years, and for that I'm grateful. And I love you, Judy. You know. But this one son, Gino, all my kids grew up in AA, and I was the Alateen dad, and I would take them to meetings every Thursday night. And but the one son, Gino, and all my sons, by the way, they all ended up going to prison, and they all ended up doing drugs and stealing cars, and they all need the fellowship. And I got one son that had 5 DUIs, and I work in substance abuse also. I do evaluations for the state of Florida. But he said this to me one time. He called me at 3 in the morning. He said, "Dad, I want to quit drinking, but I don't want to quit drinking." And I identified. My son Gino, at 24 years old, couldn't get the program, and he called a cab and went to Motel 6 and put a rope around his neck, and he hung himself. And so this disease is a deadly thing that we're dealing with here. And I love every one of you. When I say I love AA, I mean I love you, because you are AA. And the greatest gift that I ever found in AA is when I did the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the greatest decision I ever made was taking my life out of the hands of a fool. Yeah. I love you. I love AA. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bob. The next speaker is a new friend of mine from Ohio, Elvira. Wow, he was great. Let's see, what can I say? My name is Elvira Ashford, and I'm an alcoholic. I was sitting there very nervous. I was thinking, what am I supposed to say? What can I say today? And I looked at all these people. First of all, I'm so grateful to be here. And I'm so happy that Doug from the General Service Office, I work at our intergroup office in Cleveland, Ohio, and I've been there 29 years, and it's a job I love. It's the job of helping people. And Doug called the central office to ask if I could recommend some young people to speak at this conference. And I tried, and I couldn't find any. He said, well, okay, how about you? And so... So I really appreciate that. I'm grateful to him for that. And I don't know if he's here, but thank you, Doug. I have met him also, a very nice man. So I want to tell you a bit about myself. I'm from Ohio. Cleveland is my geographical cure. But I'm from Cleveland, Chicago. Chicago is my home. That's where I did my drinking, south side of Chicago. You've heard Lou Rawls talk about south side of Chicago. Well, that's where I'm from. That's where I was raised. And everybody drank, as everybody knows. Everybody drank in Chicago, right? If, you know, there's no, what else do you do? I'm a product of the 60s. I had my first drink when I was 14 years old, but I really got into the drinking after high school and during high school, the last 2 years of high school. I really got into drinking. As I say, I'm a product of the 60s, and you know the 60s, it was a mindset, you know, I was in a destructive frame of mind at that time. It was a time of cultural change, the revolution. You know, it was just the time. It was fashionable. It was hip to be radical, you know. How I thought, and I was always thought far out. I dressed far out, you know, and the big afro, you know, the clothes, the hip boots, you know. And so very self-destructive, you know. And it was, and as I mentioned, the change, a cultural change, not only from oppression, but from myself, from my family. It was a time of rebellion, of getting out, doing things, and doing things different from my family. You know, no one drank in my house. I was raised to be a good girl. Ladies, a good girl, you sit here, and you dress like this, and you be good. And, you know, ladies, little girls, don't do this. Ladies, don't do that. You be good, and you be good. And I didn't want to be good, you know. And all my life I was told to be good. And you know, I never thought I was bad. I always resented that word, but I was always told to be good. And there was one thing that I said that when I grow up I will not be, and that's good. But I, as I say, it was a time of rebellion, of, you know, just, and I was very self-destructive in the first place, you know. How I thought I was so different from my family, the things that I did. You know, and, you know, I think back of all the things you couldn't tell me anything. I didn't mix well with my peer, with other people, not even my own family.
And, you know, especially my relationship with my mother. You know, I think back now and I feel that I was always in the making of becoming an alcoholic, you know, because of my attitude. There's no way that I could have grown up to be a so-called normal person because I never thought that way. I didn't see things the way other people did. I was always defensive. I was always self-protective. I was, you know, as we say now, thin skin, and you just couldn't tell me anything. And it was, just say for other kids, I took things personal. What you said to me, I took it personal. You could tell my friend or my girlfriend or cousin, you know, to sit down, be quiet or whatever. If you told me that, I took it personal. You don't like me. That's why you say that to me. So, you know, that's it. And I hadn't had a drink. You know, I had all these things going on within me, and I hadn't even had a drink. So you know what happened and my attitude about life. You know what happened when I took that first drink. The sixes was the time of getting high. You just go, you get high. Everybody gets high. You know, you drink, you smoke a little bit, but, you know, you drink, and that's what I did. We go out, let's go out and get drunk. It was no big thing. In the beginning, it was a fun. I was a happy-go-lucky drunk. Let's go out and get drunk. And later years, I was drunk most of the time, but I didn't want you to know that I was drunk. I was drinking every day, but I didn't want you to know I was drinking, and there was a time that I would gladly tell you how high I was. But now my drinking had turned, you know, eventually it turned differently that, you know, I don't want you to know. And that's when it became a problem, as we speak about crossing a line or whatever. But when I crossed my line, that is that I wanted to be or needed to be high all the time, but I didn't want you to know that I was high. I developed a lifestyle. I like big cars, older men. I like bars, and I like staying out all night long. Now, that was a type of life that I like, and that's what I did. My first job was a switchboard operator at a hotel, and I slept all day, and I stayed up all night. To me, that was very hip, a way to live. And I thought, you know, wow, at that time, there was no problem. I could do those things, and I could still live. I could still function and take care of myself. You know, I remember the times that my mother told me, young ladies, you don't drink. If you drink, you... When my friends start bringing me home drunk, bringing me to the door, propping me up, ringing the doorbell, then she's coming, you know, to come and get me, and, you know, bringing your daughter in. You know, we say we don't hurt anyone but ourselves. I think about those days, you know, how I did hurt my mother. I was raised under a stepfather, and people bringing me home drunk, ringing the doorbell, they had a lot of arguments, and I didn't realize until later that it was about me. He was arguing with her about me, about my drinking. And that was my stepfather. I made life very difficult for my mother, but I still resented her. Everything that happened to me was her fault. But I still, I didn't realize what she went through with, you know, at the time. The neighbors, how about the neighbors? They saw people bringing me home, you know, bringing her little girl, her daughter home, that she wanted to be so nice, and I really, you know, didn't want to be nice, and I wasn't, you know. She told me when you're out and you get drunk that this will happen to you. That happens to you. This happens to you. And I'm looking at her, yeah, well, you don't never go anywhere. How do you know? You know, you're always at home. You don't know what's going on out there. You don't know. Nobody's going to bother me. No, you know. I hadn't met the people that my mother told me about, but I did meet them. My drinking took me to places that I would have never been, and I was in the company of people that I would have never been with if it hadn't been for the alcohol. I did meet the people that my mother spoke about, and a lot that she didn't, some she didn't even know about, but I eventually met them. If you're out there, you meet them. That was a carefree time. I got married, my first husband. I didn't realize that he didn't drink until after we got married, and when he told me he didn't want his wife drinking in the bar anymore, that was resentment number one. We were married 8 years, and I spent 8 years getting away from this man, trying to do all kinds of things to get away from him. And here I go again. Now, we don't go to bars anymore, but I'm still going to bars. Friends now are bringing me home again to my husband, propping me up at the door, ringing the doorbell. I can't find my key, so he's coming in. And neighbors, you know, again, why can't I drink if I want to? I'm not hurting anyone but myself. I didn't realize how embarrassed this man was. People bringing his wife home drunk. The neighbors knew it. You know, they heard me when I got in playing the music, you know, maybe asking him for a fight, you know, with the frustration that's going on with me, neighbors. You know, I didn't realize what the man was going through with, but he now, he's with this be good business, and when I knew anything, you know, he don't want me to drink, you know, I think back, and I didn't like him, and I did eventually leave him. That's when I went to Cleveland. But I didn't like him, but I didn't realize that all the man wanted was a wife. He did not want a sober wife. I didn't realize till I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that no man wants a drunk woman. I didn't know that, you know. I thought I was hip. I was cool. I didn't think I was hurting anyone. But I did hurt the man dearly. I can remember the stages of my drinking after I stopped going out to parties and bars or whatever. Then I started going through what I call binge drinking. I would drink for maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. And I wouldn't drink anymore for a while. The second stage was the hiding, the sneak drinking. And that is, I would bring a bottle in, and I didn't know how to cook. I never did learn how to cook. And he always wanted to eat, so I was trying. I would get in the kitchen. I'm trying to cook something, and I'd sneak the bottle in with me. And I'm drinking from the bottle in a big glass, and it's not frying up and cooking up fast enough, so I turn it off and I go to bed. I'm drunk. So he's shaking me. Hey, where is my bed? Or what about my food? You know, I'm in the bed. But, you know, I was very confused at that time. I didn't realize what happened. You know, I was wondering what happened to the carefree person that I used to be. I used to just pace, trying to figure out what happened to yesterday. What happened to me? What has happened that now I can't drink? And one or two drink, I'm drunk, you know. I couldn't figure out. Then he's always wanting to know, why do you drink the way you do? Well, I don't know why I drink the way that I do. He was always in my face wanting to know why I drink the way that I do. Am I the reason that you drink the way that you do? Yes, you're the reason that I drink the way that I do. You know, what can I say? So somebody's got to take blame for this, because I'm just as confused as you are. When I leave here in the morning going to work, I have no intention of coming back tonight drunk. But it happened over and over. And that compulsion to drink superseded everything. Whatever he said, the threats or whatever, I will do this by whatever. When it came time to drink, I could not control myself. The last stage of my drinking, I would say, was the suicidal time. And that is the time that I'm drinking now, and I'm drinking it out of desperation. You know, I am really drinking, and I really am confused. I don't know why. And I have a bottle in my purse most of the time, and I'm smelling like alcohol. And I'm going to bed, and I'm, you know, I didn't care. I was hoping that I didn't wake up. I was so unhappy when I was sober. The times that I didn't drink, I was as unhappy sober, you know, as I was drinking. I was, you know, it was a limbo, a time in my life that I was very confused. I really didn't know what to do. I was working for Sears Roebuck at that time. I was working in the billing department, and I was doing some work, and it was the merchandise was coming to Cleveland. And I remember that I had relatives here, and I asked for a transfer. And I left my husband, my family, my mother, my friends, my home, everything that I knew. And I came to Cleveland August 20th, 1970 with one suitcase. September the 4th, 1971, I was called in AA. I did not last a year in Cleveland. But as I say, Cleveland was my geographical care. The last time I was in the hospital there, she suggested, your niece is an alcoholic. If she wants to live, she should call this number, which was AA. While I was there, they moved my clothes from their home. They got me an apartment. They picked me up from the hospital, took me to my own apartment. When I got there, I was amazed. My clothes were hanging up in the closet. Everything was there. They gave me the key, and they left. And I am standing there, and for the first time in my life, I'm on my own. And I took an inventory. I didn't know that it wasn't an inventory. But I really did realize I cannot drink and take care of me. My aunt say, if you go back to a man, once you leave a man, you go back, then he will really treat you bad. So I was afraid to go back to Chicago to my husband. And so, you know, by the way, I call myself leaving him. And he made one call to Cleveland, and I was sitting there. I think I'd been there about 3 or 4 days. And my aunt answered the phone, and she says, your husband's on the phone. I says, oh, I perked up. I thought he was, you know, calling for me to come home. So she says, and then she hung up. I says, well, I wanted to tell, what did he say? Did he want me to come home? She said, no, he just wanted to know if you're here. I never heard from him again. He just wanted to know. He just wanted to know where I was. Never saw him again. You know, I never. He kept in touch with my family in Chicago, but I never saw him. He was a good man. He just didn't want a drunk woman. I called AA. They sent a nice lady out, called on me. I came in, I had no intentions. I didn't come here because I wanted to stop drinking. I came here because I didn't know what else to do. This nice lady called me every day, and wow, and I went. She took an interest in me. In fact, seems like to me she cared more for me than I did myself. I really didn't care. But the lady called me every day, and when she called, I went because I had parted company with Sears. They say they didn't fire me, but they wouldn't let me come back, so I don't know what was going on. So I was getting my conversation. I still slept all day, and I'm reading these books and things all evening, and I went to a meeting, and thank God. When I came into AA, as I say, I came here with this big Angela Davis afro. I had these hip boots on. I had the pants tucked into them. It was 1970, the time of, you know, it was still a militant. I was still a militant, you know. I'm still raising my fist. I'm still militant. And I walked in AA meetings, and these people sitting here so calm, you know, where did these people come from? Don't they know there's a war going on out there? You know, I couldn't understand. But anyway, it was my time, and I kept coming. She called me, and I kept coming to meetings. Thank God. And I want to rush through this because he mentioned his wife in AA. And I met my second husband in AA. And he was like me. You know, I met him. He had the big afro, the beard, the dark glasses, the boots, and the thing in his belt. He looked just like Castro. And I'm sitting there one day watching him. And we, you know, naturally, we were about the same age. We gravitated to each other, and we started dating. And the next day, we did get married. And it was a good life. I really enjoyed my sobriety, my life. You know, I didn't say anything about spirituality yet, but I was raised as a Baptist in church. The church had always been a part of my life, religion. I wouldn't say that I was an agnostic or whatever, because I knew better. I knew about religion, as I say, and as a child, I was raised in the church. But there's one thing that I did say is when I got grown, there are two, three things that I would not do anymore. And go to church was number one on my list. And from the time that I started drinking, I didn't go to church for 17 years. The God that I knew was the punishing God. And he said that everything that I liked to do, It was sin. And everything, you know, it just was no point in me even bothering because I was going to hell and I knew it. So I didn't even waste my time going to church. I didn't even think about a higher power or God. But as I have read, deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is a fundamental belief in a God or a higher power. And that has, and it, I know that that was so with me. When I was sober 5 years, I realized that something was missing in my life. AA was my life, was the most important part of my life, the spirituality. He spoke on the steps eloquently, so I want, you know, have to get into that. But the 12 steps are guidelines for living, and certainly my guideline for living is what I live by. It has given me a better quality of life, a reason for living. And it's what the steps, the inventor, is what I use, the philosophy of AA, the 12 steps. So something was missing, and that was the church, the singing. And I had never been baptized. I started going to church, my husband and I. And he was baptized, I wasn't. We joined the church. I got baptized. I felt real good. Went to church every Sunday. But once I felt that I was living the way God intended for people to live, I was safely married. I had no messing around with anybody else's husband anymore. You know, my spiritual awakening for me was very simple. Bill Wilson spoke of his spiritual awakening, but mine was very simple. And that was a desire to be a better person. All of a sudden, I just wanted to be a good person and not the person that I used to be. So we go to church. I'm baptized. We go to church. It was, life went on. I had a serious illness, and things happen. AA teaches me how to live. We got burned out. But, you know, I had a good relationship with God. I went to church every Sunday, as I mentioned, and I was very happy. And I am back there now. But I want to tell you this. During that time, after that time, my husband got sick, and we'd been married 16 years. My husband got sick, and it was an illness that he was in AA. He didn't want to deal with it. Now, when he didn't want to deal with his illness, and he told me so many times. So when I came home one day and I found my husband dead on the floor, and the fact that he had killed himself was just so much, too much for, you know, I just reverted all the spirituality and religion that I felt, you know. Now, I was angry. I went through many stages after my husband's suicide. I was sober 20 years at that time. But my mind reverted back to the first year that I came to this program, and I was angry with God. I stopped going to church. I blamed him. I blamed my husband. I blamed everybody for my misery at the time. And going through these changes, I was told that I needed help. So I finally had to go and get help. It took a couple of years with psychiatric help, counseling, and a good sponsor. And my sponsor is here. Hello, Cleveland. I know there are a lot of Cleveland people here, too. Hi. Hello. Hi. So with the help of my friends in AA, I got through that. But today, I'm over that. I'm back in the church. And I feel so good. In fact, I'm closer to God more now than ever. I have a deeper understanding of God. I don't know if I told you my sobriety date is September 4, 1971, if I didn't tell you that. And I've been sober 33 years. And I work, as I say, I work at the central office 29 years, I enjoy every minute of it. I can take one day of answering the phone, and, you know, I could write a book of some of the incidents and things that people call. The latest thing we had with this man called, he's tired of going to the meetings, the judge is making him go to the meetings, and if he mails his book to us at the office with a self-stamped envelope, would we sign it and mail it back to him? David is here. He's my co-worker. You know, I'm sure I've talked 20 minutes, but it's very rewarding, as he mentioned. After my own sobriety, the next rewarding, most rewarding thing for me is to sponsor someone and watch them get sober. This writer says about spirituality, and my spiritual awakening was to be a good person. And this one says that some simple things that we can do for, to enhance our spirituality. And the first one is eliminate sin from our lives. Develop humility. Constantly pray to God for guidance. Practice charity. And meditate. And I do that. I try to do those things every day. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elvira. Our third speaker is from the eastern part of my own state, Massachusetts, and his name is Jim.
I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Somebody was asking me before the meeting started if I was nervous, and the truth is, I went to the bathroom 3 times before I got up here, and the last 2 times I just stood there. And I've been sitting up here just chugging water the whole time, and now I really have to go to the bathroom. So. It's not nice to make the newest guy go last. This is a big meeting. And it's pretty cool to be here. And it's pretty great to wake up on a Saturday morning and feel great. Beautiful day, and go have coffee and read the paper and not feel hungover and not be shaken and not having that smell coming through your skin or that taste in your mouth or trying to drink so much water to rehydrate yourself and just feeling awful and worried about what happened the night before, not sure what happened the night before, what's going to happen next week. It's great to be sober, and it's great to be here. Last night I thought in that stadium was just, that was awesome. I was talking to somebody on the phone today, and I said there were 60,000 alcoholics for a meeting in Toronto last night. I was told later there was something more like 40 or 45, I don't know. I was sitting up here thinking, I don't think I've ever spoken in front of a group this large, except for, and then I was thinking, you know what, there was one time in college freshman year, and I was a pledge in a fraternity. And if you're a pledge in a fraternity, one of the things that the guys that are already brothers in the fraternity like to do, they like to, you know, come find the pledges when they least expect them and make them do very embarrassing things. And this was Valentine's Day, 1992, and these guys showed up in my room one morning at like 7 o'clock in the morning and took me to their room, and they were giving me shots of bourbon, and it was Valentine's Day, so they decided to make me Cupid the Love God. And they had lipstick, and they put lipstick on me, and they put hearts on me, and, you know, with the arrows going through, and they made me a giant human diaper. And they took me to Mikosh 10, which was the largest hall at my university, and they said, we want you to jump up on stage and say this poem. And they gave me a sword, and I put the sword in my diaper. And I stood in the, you know, had a door behind the stage, and I stood there for 20 minutes just freaking out, drinking bourbon and trying to get the courage up to do it. And finally, I just burst in there and jumped up on the stage, and I said, I'm Cupid the Love God, lifting my rod. And I hadn't realized that the sword was actually holding up the diaper, and I pulled the rod up. And if anybody here happened to be in the room that day, I just want to say that it was snowing outside. It was very cold. So, you know, it's actually kind of an interesting metaphor because I think I was afraid of being naked for a long time. metaphorically speaking, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. It made me feel pretty good. And you know, I owe my life to this program in more ways than one. I this program has changed my life. My sobriety date is June 22nd, 2003. And, you know, I'm also, my parents met at an AA meeting in Malibu 39 years ago, so that also makes me an AA love child, so. And, if you had told me 3 years ago that I'd be, you know, making the pilgrimage this weekend to AA Mecca, I... No way. And if you had told me that I'd be standing in front of a room full of people talking about, you know, finding my higher power, I think I might have kept drinking, actually. I don't know. But I came into AA in just a giant cloud of suckiness. And... My life sucked, and I was very, very angry, because I knew I was alcoholic, and I did not want to be alcoholic, and I didn't want to be an AA, and I'd grown up around this program, and I'd seen, you know, when you're a little kid growing up around this program, in our house there were a lot of alcoholics that were struggling, and you know, our parents were both very active in AA in Laguna Beach, and so there were always people that were struggling in our house, and those people would, you know, someone would die, someone would commit suicide, and you can tell even when you're a little kid that people are struggling, and so I think as a little kid that was scary to me, and so I didn't want to be in the program, but I came, and I came in 2002 in the summer after... several just, you know, horrible events. It got bad for everybody. And I was scared, you know. I went to a big meeting in Boston, and I was hiding in the back. I was afraid somebody was going to see me. I was afraid they were going to figure out I was an alcoholic. I hated having to say that I was, you know, hi, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I just had this wall up. I like, in New Pair of Glasses, Chuck C. talks about ego. And he describes it as a feeling of conscious separation from. And that was me. I was just a giant wall of ego. And I was afraid to let anybody in. You know, and it was just this giant wall that separated me from you and me from God and me from myself. And it took me a year to get through that and to break that down. And I was, after a year of kind of coming and going in the program, I was at the Park Street Beginners meeting a little over 2 years ago, and I had some great insight into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I'd share it with all the newcomers that were in AA, and so I raised my hand at the Beginners meeting at Park Street, and I said, "There is no God. This program is a sham. It's not going to work. I read We Agnostics. In We Agnostics, it said, we found God because we were desperate. And if they only found God because they were desperate, that's proof right there, there is no God. And I'm out of here." And I actually stayed till the end of the meeting. And a gentleman here in the front row came up to me at the end of the meeting and patted me on the back and said, "Way to go, that's where you got to get it." And I thought, you know what, these people are crazy. And I left that meeting, and I went to a liquor store on Newberry Street, and I sat on the stairs outside that liquor store. And actually, before then, I ran into some people at a coffee shop on Newberry Street, and I said, you know, I'm miserable, this sucks, I don't want to be here, I don't want to feel this way for the rest of my life, this doesn't work, and this... Very nice young lady said, you know, Jim, it's just a day at a time. I said, it's not a day at a time. It's the rest of my damn life. And then I went to the liquor store. And I sat on the steps before I walked in, and I called my sponsor. And I didn't tell him that I was going in to buy a couple bottles of wine. And I called my girlfriend, who's at a wedding waiting for me. I was supposed to fly out the next morning. And then I went down and bought a couple bottles of wine. And I thought that I would just drink them, get it out of my system so that I could go to this wedding and not drink and be okay. And I missed the flight. And it turns out the wedding was this woman that I've been dating for 9 years. I've been living with her for several years. And it was her sister's wedding. I was a groomsman in it. And I missed the flight. I neglected to call, so I missed the rehearsal dinner. And then I flew down the next morning on a plane and showed up in time for the wedding. And I called from the airport, and they said, you're not welcome at this wedding. And so I turned around and flew back to Boston. And that was kind of a bummer weekend. And the next morning I woke up in the emergency room at one of the hospitals in Boston, and there was this pimply doctor that was couldn't have been a year out of medical school, and he's trying to talk to me, you know. He's trying to say you really shouldn't do that stuff, and, you know, why did you do this? And then they sent in this guy who was some sort of social worker or something, and he came in and he sat down and he said, you know, I don't remember his name, but he said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And it was like, right away, you know, I just completely opened up to him. And I just said, I can't take this anymore. I'm dying. I'm so scared. I can't stop. My life is awful. And it was just amazing that when two alcoholics get together and they identify themselves as alcoholics, that it's just like they can just communicate so freely because they know. You know, they know what it's like, and they've been there. And I'd never met this guy before, but, you know, a minute earlier, some doctor was trying to talk to me to, you know, help me through this situation, and this guy walked in, and it was like, I instantly opened up to him, and he said, your life doesn't have to be like this. You don't have to feel this way anymore. And that was the beginning of the journey for me. And my home group now is the Back Bay Steps group in the Back Bay of Boston. And we do a step, it's a step meeting, it's a different step every day. And for me, you know, as I just highlighted, there was no God in my life when I came into the program. And every time I thought about the God concept, it was the reason why I wasn't going to buy into this program. So for me, there was no, you know, I grew up going to church, and I had God, and but when I needed to turn to God to get sober, there was just no way I was going to do that. And somebody said to me, you know, just try it. Try praying. And so I started praying. I started praying to a God that I didn't know existed or if it existed. And, you know, initially I would just say, I would talk to people that had been in the program for a while, and I'd say the serenity prayer, or I'd just say a short prayer like, God, help me to stay in the moment. Help me get out of my own way. And I would say the third step prayer a lot. I like that prayer because, you know, for me in the beginning, it was just all about remove me from the bondage of self. You know, just lift this pain, lift this cloud of suckiness from my life. And I did that a lot. And, you know, in the first several months, there was a lot of misery. And I didn't know what God was. And all I knew was that somehow by praying, it got me out of myself. It got me out of my own head. It got me out of whatever I was worrying about. And that was the most important thing. And I started, you know, when I was trying to get sober that first year, people used to say, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days and all that kind of stuff. And I just said, I got a full life. I got a job. I got weddings. I got parties. I got a girlfriend. That's not going to work for me. And so, no surprise, it didn't. And this time, I dove in, you know. And it started to make a difference. You know, slowly I started to change. And And I heard somebody say on the East Coast once, he was talking about some sort of, I don't know where this comes from, I don't think it's in the AA literature, but he said, if it is happiness you seek, happiness is the way. And if it is peace you seek, peace is the way. And what I realize now, just looking back over the last couple of years, for me, you know, I was seeking my higher power, but my higher power was the way. You know, it was going to meetings was a spiritual thing. And picking up the phone and calling my sponsor was a spiritual thing. And helping newcomers was a spiritual thing. And going on commitments was a spiritual thing. And being honest with people was a spiritual thing. Taking an inventory was a spiritual thing. All of those things that I did along the way without really even so much of this thinking of God, those were the things that helped me, you know, find a spiritual life. And I was the last person, and I am still probably the last person to tell you that I'm a very spiritual person. But what I've realized in the last 6 months is that I've found spirituality without even realizing it. You know, it's just a part of me now, and that cloud of suckiness has lifted. And it's lifted because I've worked the steps, and I've had so much fear about going back out and drinking again because I know what's going to happen, you know. And I'm not sure I have another recovery in me either. And somebody said here, and he's actually sitting in the front row, I don't even know his name, but he said at a meeting once that the steps are like music. And first you kind of study them in order, and then they kind of flow. They're like notes, I guess, and you study them in order, and then they kind of flow through your life like music. And I like that a lot. And that's kind of how I think about it now. You know, like the steps have definitely saved my life, and the steps for me were the pathway to finding spirituality. And to this day, I still don't know if my higher power is God. I don't know if it's what it is. You know, I go to church on Sundays every once in a while, but I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know if I believe, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, all that matters is that I have that feeling of wholeness and that feeling of being a part of. And it's really that wall that I used to have, that feeling of conscious separation from, that ego. When that came down, you know, I was talking about being naked in front of the room at the beginning of the meeting, like, that's that, you know, there's just this, it's a wall that protects me from being naked and from letting you in. And what spirituality is for me is it's just that, it's what fills that, where that wall used to be, you know? And thank God for that. And, you know, as I said at the beginning, I'm so happy to be here. It's, I'm not normally into, like, these convention type things, but, it's great to be sober, and it's great to be a part of this just incredible thing. So thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Jim. I won't forget the phrase, the cloud of suckiness, for a long time. Nor will I forget hugging pine trees. And I, too, have been dropped off drunk at front doors. One of the things they suggest to the chairs at this meeting is that if there are a few minutes left, you might share a bit of your own experience, strength, and hope. And I won't take the whole time, but I will say a couple things about finding a higher power. One is a memory from my first sponsor, to whom I said, I like this AA stuff except for the God part. And she said, tell me what you did when you drank. She said, you told me you like to drink alone, and tell me what you did when you drank. And I talked to her about the special glass I had and the special lighting I like to, you know, arrange and all the sort of special accoutrements that were designed to convince myself that I was still a lady. And She said, you know what you were doing? You were creating a little religious ceremony for yourself, and then you were drinking. And I hated her for saying that, because it was true. And it was one of the first times somebody hit me sort of between the eyes with the notion that that I actually had a yearning for a spiritual life. And then I went to a meeting right around the same time, actually, in Connecticut, and like within a couple weeks, and this gentleman stood up and he said, an alcoholic is somebody who has a spiritual calling and goes to the wrong address. And between those two things, I said, maybe I should open my eyes and my heart and my ears a little bit. Fast forward many years, 12 years, from the time I got sober to today. There's this meeting we're in called Finding the Higher Power, and it's still typical of me today. I decided to try to rewrite the title. I said, what's finding a higher power? I think what I want to say about finding a higher power is that you shouldn't try to find a higher power, or at least I can't try to find a higher power. I can only find a higher power the way I found sobriety, which was by not trying to find it, by simply letting it in, by simply giving up, by surrendering. And that's when I have a sense, the deepest sense of my higher power is when I give up, as I think I and 45,000 other people did last night when my higher power became known as Amazing Grace. I want you to join me in thanking our speakers warmly, Jim, Bob, and Elvira. And I want to thank you for being here, and I want to see all of you at the Old Timers meeting tonight. Thank you. But also, for those who care to, please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.